Thanks for listening to Press Play. If you're like me and you need help navigating the busy film awards season, I have a podcast just for you. It's called The Treatment, and it's hosted by Elvis Mitchell. And Elvis really goes beyond the simple plot outline to understand what inspires the people who make these movies, the actors, the filmmakers, the producers. So check it out, The Treatment, on KCRW's iTunes page.
Car. What's the retail on one of those?
More than you can afford, pal. Ferrari.
Smoke.
And that's from the movie Fast and Furious. Well, your car may sound fast and furious these days, but the auto industry's secret, that engine sound may be fake. We'll get into that later in the show. But first, Saudi Arabia's King Abdullah died last night at the age of 90. His brother Prince Salman, who's 79 years old, has taken over the throne. Abdullah was king for almost a decade, and he ruled in the former King Fahd's name for another decade before that. Vice President Joe Biden will lead the U.S. delegation to honor the king, a close ally in the region. In a country where human rights are sharply curtailed by conservative Islamic religious law, King Abdullah has been described as a cautious reformer. Saudi women got the right to vote during his rule, but didn't make good on his promise to allow them to drive. I'm joined now by Borzu Deragahi. He's been covering the region for a long time, most recently as Middle East reporter for the Financial Times, and he has a long view on this story. Borzu, welcome.
Hi, it's my pleasure.
Well, today the world has been focused on King Abdullah's life and his legacy. I'm curious how the Western media coverage of the king is playing in Saudi Arabia and the Middle East. Is there an East-West disjunct?
Well, I think there's, in the Middle East in general, among the rulers and the ruling clique, this has been declared a big holiday. In Egypt, they declared 7 days of mourning for the king. King Abdullah is passing, but I think among ordinary people there's either apathy or outright hostility towards the role of Saudi Arabia, the role that Saudi Arabia has in the region. I think there's a real, I think unfortunately right now in the region most of the official coverage of the king's passing is rather gushing and uncritical. It's been partly gushing and uncritical in the Western press as well, but there have been some criticism, some noting of the lack of progress on human rights and civil liberties in Saudi Arabia over the past 10 years, 20 years really, where he's been de facto ruling over the country.
And put that in the context of the U.S. Relationship with the kingdom, which is close. We're allies against Iran. It's been close because we're, in large part, because we're dependent on the nation's oil. And we've kind of looked the other way when it came to the lack of democracy and the civil rights in that country that, as you say, the people are feels disenfranchised because of. So give us a closer sense of what role Saudi Arabia is playing in the region now and how might King Abdullah's passing affect this complex U.S.-Saudi Arabia relationship?
Well, I mean, it's complex, as you point out. But, one could argue that, at least as far as the kingdom itself goes, as far as Saudi Arabia, there is some sort of adherence to a social contract, i.e., the Saudi royal family gets to rule. And in return, there's relative economic growth. There is good access to public services for the vast majority of the people there. Salaries are pretty high. The quality of life there is pretty decent. I think that and you could argue that the people by and large in Saudi Arabia embrace that pact with the Saudi royal family. But I think that what one of the big questions that has risen in the last few months, but also in the last few years become more intense, is the kind of what many would describe as a corrosive ideological influence that the kind of Islam, the sort of Wahhabi school of Islam not just practiced by Saudi Arabia, but actively propagated throughout the whole Muslim world, has been detrimental. That from Mauritania to Indonesia, and from Paris to New Jersey, the Saudi influence has been rather negative, many would say, in terms of squelching the voices of free thinkers, in terms of preventing liberal or even atheistic voices within the Muslim community from speaking out and finding credibility, from finding a voice. And that's been a rather negative effect, and that's been highlighted recently by some people who've noted the similarities between the ideology of the Saudi kingdom and the religious practices it encourages and the tenets of the Islamic State of Iraq and the Levant, ISIS, the caliphate that has seized control of parts of Syria and Iraq and is trying to find footholds in Libya and other parts of the Middle East.
Well, King Abdullah was considered in part a voice of moderation in some ways, right? He took some action to quell extremism. So how does his brother, Prince, and now King Salman compare on this front, and what stance is he likely to take against conservative clerics?
Well, it's hard to say. You know, on the one hand, they are against the Islamic State. Not only are they against the Islamic State, not only are they against Al-Qaeda, they are contributing significantly to the effort to fight these groups militarily and are cracking down on their networks on the Arabian Peninsula. On the other hand, they legitimize the ideology that ISIS expounds by practicing it themselves. You know, I mean, I saw a very interesting chart that had a comparison of punishments in Saudi Arabia for various crimes to those punishments in the caliphate, in the Islamic State's territory, which they control. You know, they're quite similar. So I think there needs to be, in the eyes of many people in the region, a much more fundamental change in Saudi Arabia for it to be for either the king or for the system there to be considered truly reformist.
I was noticing population trends in the Middle East today. A lot of the countries in the Middle East have very young populations. Almost half of Saudi Arabia's population is under the age of 25. How does this younger population view the ruling elite?
Well, I mean, it's hard to say, and I think that there's various circles of people, and these are very complex countries, you know, with tribal and religious minorities that are sometimes on the inside of the circle of power and sometimes outside of the circle of power. And so, you know, it's hard to sort of generalize on that. But generally, the young people in these parts of the world are connected to the internet, connected to satellite television. You know, they aspire to some of the things in the West. There's countless examples that I can point to in the region where the one very westernized section of town, of any town, or the one little space where there's some freedom is where all the young people go, you know, to hang out. Mm-hmm. I can point that out over and over again. And so basically what happens is people are sort of forced into this life of hypocrisy where the most decadent abuses and uses of substances and sexuality unfold behind private closed doors, and they act like they're very pious in public. And this is all over the Middle East.
I did want to fit in one question about briefly about Yemen, which is immediately south on the Arabian Peninsula from Saudi Arabia. It's a country in which the Arab Spring has created a lot of tumult, and Shiite rebels called Houthi now control parts of the country, and now the president and his cabinet have resigned. So how does this instability in Yemen, how might it complicate the already difficult situation in the region?
Well, Yemen has long been a very weak state with a lot of unpatrolled, vast desert areas that have been used as bases by extremist groups. And this is not good. This is a further deterioration of the power of the state, a further decline in the kind of Yemeni ability to control those areas. So it's not a good step. On the other hand, you know, this has been going on for a while, and what happened in the last couple of days with this agreement between the president, Abdurrabu Mansour Hadi, and this the Houthi rebels, this agreement collapsing, and then the president resigning You know, this is not necessarily the end of the road. But on the other hand, it is part of a trajectory, a downward trajectory, in the ability of Yemen to police its uncontrolled badlands.
Borzu Dariahi is Middle East reporter for the Financial Times. He joined us from Cairo. Thank you very much for taking the time. I appreciate it.
It's been a pleasure.
Elsewhere in the Middle East today, Hayat Boumediene, the girlfriend of one of the terrorists who attacked Paris 2 weeks ago, may be in Syria. French police are still searching for her, and the investigation highlights one of the more overlooked aspects of jihadism, the role of women. About 10% of Westerners recruited into the Islamic extremist group ISIS are women. That number is twice as high in France, and they're taking active roles in planning and executing attacks. Jane Huckerbee is an associate clinical professor of law and the director of the International Human Rights Clinic at the Duke University School of Law, and she joins us now. Welcome to the show.
Thank you, Barbara.
Where are these women coming from?
These are women who are coming from primarily Western European countries. They are predominantly coming from the United Kingdom, but as you mentioned, the number seems to be quite significantly higher in France as well.
And why is it more prevalent in France?
There are a number of reasons that European women in ISIS have given for traveling to Syria and Iraq. One of the major reasons that they give is feelings of alienation and inability to practice their religion. Policies like France's ban on wearing the burqa in public. Ms. Hayat Boumediene reportedly lost her job as a cashier for wearing the niqab in France. Also feelings of inequality, sense of adventure, for some a sense of romance. Some of these young girls joining to become jihadi brides, to marry fighters. Many of them are also responding to the call from ISIS for women to come and be an equal part of a state-building exercise. So it's a mixture of factors, many of which are the same for men.
And how are they being recruited?
Using social media networks, using instant messaging, young women are bringing other women over to the group, talking about their lives under ISIS, giving them very practical travel advice on how to cross into Syria, for example, from Turkey, and really trying to appeal to their sense of adventure and their role they can have once in Syria.
So a number of methods to make this attractive to these perhaps disenfranchised feeling women. Well, you pointed out in a recent op-ed in the New York Times that one of the gender biases that comes into play here in this conversation is that we tend to think of women in ISIS or similar terrorist groups as relegated to subservient wife roles, but that's not necessarily the case. So what role or roles do they play?
They are recruiters for the group, as we just discussed. They can also be fundraisers. They also operate checkpoints and go on home raids precisely because they can search women. They also are very involved in rebranding the image of ISIS and trying to make ISIS more appealing, to make it seem less of a terrorist group and more of a state-building exercise. So they use Twitter and Instagram to really build up a picture of life under ISIS and also to celebrate its victories.
Well, what other misconceptions then about female terrorists have you tracked?
Governments have long overlooked and underrated female terrorism. A number of misconceptions have really caused these blind spots on female terrorism. The first is a big stereotype around the idea that women are very passive, that they're always peaceful, they have to be tricked into joining terrorist groups, for example. And we tend to really focus on that idea of women as victims of terrorism, rather than really trying to figure out why do women join terrorist groups, what do they do when they're there, and how do we deal with them if they return.
And what policy follows if security forces or anti-terror operatives think more along those lines? How do you recommend they change their approach to take this into account?
And for some governments, that question is as easy as recognizing that there is a problem with female terrorism. Many governments still deny that. The next step is to then really look at the complex motivations in both the push and pull factors that lead women to these groups. The third step is to, again, trying to really understand what their roles are in these groups. If some women are there as wives, that's, you know, one question. Other women in other groups, for example, maybe are used as suicide bombers. So we need to really understand this complexity of roles. And then to, as governments are increasingly grappling with the challenge of how to handle returning foreign terrorist fighters from Syria and Iraq, paying particular attention to the needs of women who may return, thinking about what programs need to be designed to take account of their particular experiences in the group.
Jean Huckerby, she's an associate clinical professor of law and the director of the International Human Rights Clinic at the Duke University School of Law. And thank you very much for taking the time.
Thank you, Barbara.
Well, moving on, coming up, don't have a boyfriend or a girlfriend? No worries, there's an app for that. The rise of the virtual significant other. Let's call him Ryan Gosling. That's next on Press Play.
Take KCRW with you on one of our smartphone apps. Available for the iPhone, Android, and BlackBerry. You can stream KCRW live, listen to podcasts, and all our news and music streams. Learn more and download at kcrw.com/apps.
This is Press Play. I'm Barbara Bogavin for Madeline Brand. Mom, Dad, stop asking. Yes, I am dating someone. His name is Ryan. That's right. That's what Caitlin Dewey named her fake boy toy when she signed up for the new service called Invisible Boyfriend. The new service allows you to silence all those pesky friends and family who keep hounding you to meet someone. Caitlin Dewey runs the Intersect blog, and she writes about digital and internet culture for The Washington Post. And welcome to this show.
Hi, how are you?
Oh, it's great to have you on. People are loving this, and I'm kind of loving this. Who wouldn't? I mean, I'm not sure what it is, though. It sounds like you have a fake relationship with a real person who's pretending to be someone they're not, and all of this in an app. It's like basically catfishing yourself. Please explain.
Yes, you are right. It is extremely complicated. So the point of Invisible Boyfriend basically is to create a kind of decoy boyfriend or girlfriend. There's also a girlfriend service to throw pestering relatives or friends off your trail. So what you do is you sign up for the site, you design the man or woman of your dreams, you get to pick their personality and everything.
Oh, and you get to make an avatar, like in
yes.
a video game.
Okay. Yeah, you get to pick a picture for them, whatever your type is. And then for $25 a month, that person, quote unquote, will text you 100 times, they'll leave you 10 voicemails. And in the future, they might do other things like send flowers to your office to kind of quote-unquote, prove that you have a boyfriend when, of course, you do not.
And this is a person on the other line, not a bot.
It's not a bot, but it's also not one person. In fact, when you text someone, as I learned the hard way, a different person is actually responding to each of your text messages. And for the most part, these are freelancers working remotely, almost like a call center situation all over the world.
Okay, well, give us a window into your boyfriend who you did name Ryan Gosling, right?
Yes, his name is Ryan Gosling. He is 34 years old, like the real Ryan Gosling. And
good.
When
good
I
start.
Started texting him, I was, of course, convinced it was a bot because I didn't understand technologically how else the service could work. So I decided to try to trip up the bot by telling him a lot of like really pathetic, fake things about myself to see what he would say. And when I said that I was crying myself to sleep and watching Downton Abbey, I was disturbed that this character responded as a human would and not as a bot would.
How did he respond?
Well, he asked me why Ryan. I was crying.
Aww.
And then he told me he also liked Downton Abbey and Thomas was his favorite character.
Thomas. Thomas is awful. That's weird.
I said if this was a bot, they surely would not have programmed it to pick Thomas as a favorite character.
Ah, so that was the tip-off. So what's the level of intimacy, then, that you have achieved with Ryan? What can one expect from this app?
Well, you know, the interesting thing to me is that it does very quickly create that illusion of intimacy. You do feel the urge to respond to the text messages. you do sort of want to build a rapport with this quote-unquote person automatically. Even after I understood how it worked, I knew I was talking to different people. I knew that each text was going to a new person who would have no knowledge of the things I had disclosed to it before. You still, just by virtue of, I guess, being on a phone and that sort of mental model that we have for texting people, you still feel a certain draw to it. You're still embarrassed when you say something stupid. You're still curious as to how they'll respond. So I thought that was really intriguing, and it's especially intriguing to me because the founder of the service has been really adamant that, you know, this is just to deceive people like your parents. We're not designing this as a substitute for love. You know, the user herself should not fall in love with this character.
Right, Caitlin, but it's not about you.
Right, exactly.
it's about him.
I see how it could be, right?
Right. No, sure. And it was interesting that you said before that you were more disturbed that whoever you were communicating with was human and not a bot. That's kind of an interesting, weird expectation or reaction.
Right. That was strange. Well, it was because I had disclosed things to it that were, I mean, they weren't true, but they were very personal. And I was immediately very embarrassed that it was a person, even if it was a stranger. I think it's just sort of a natural emotional connection that we have with any other person, regardless of how we're interfacing with them, whether it's a, you know, fake text message, Ryan Gosling character or not.
Right. And I'm sure we're all flashing back to the movie Her, with, you know, you create these relationships. They can become very intimate, and even though you who knows who you were talking to, Caitlin?
Exactly. Right. Yeah. Who knows who I was talking to? It could have been a man, a woman, an old person, a young person. You know, they could be down the street in D.C. They could be in the Philippines. I really have no idea. But it's still, the character is very compelling. And I think the fact that it is through text message, which is sort of disembodied anyways, it lets you sort of project a personality or a character on it, even when you know in reality there's no one there.
Well, I know it's still the first week for the company, but you found out that a lot of people who signed up are overseas. Do you have any theories why that is?
Well, the founder of the company thinks the reason is, which is really interesting to me, is that overseas, as opposed to the U.S., there are still some very strong cultural stigmas against being single after a certain age. And even sort of more dramatically, there's a lot of stigma against being lesbian or gay. And if people are closeted and they want to give, you know, quote-unquote, evidence that they are not, in fact, gay, they could use something like this service to prove it to their parents or whomever else. So in that sense, it seems like maybe there's more of a social utility than, you know, the silliness and the novelty of Invisible Boyfriend would initially suggest.
No, I can see it going all sorts of ways. You could use it to make someone jealous.
Oh, absolutely. And I'm sure many of the 5,000 people who have signed up are doing exactly that.
Well, so what happens if your invisible boyfriend dumps you, though? what then?
Well, I would certainly complain to the company, since you are paying for your invisible boyfriend.
$25 a month, you better stick around.
Exactly. But I think I'm going to have to dump my invisible boyfriend, because I do, of course, have a real boyfriend who I think has had enough of this.
Caitlin Dewey, she runs the Intersect blog and writes about digital and internet culture for the Washington Post, and maybe still has or had a boyfriend named Ryan Gosling. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Well, having an invisible boyfriend or girlfriend may seem weird, but maybe not. Let us know if you would sign up for one. Or if a significant other isn't what you're looking for, what other invisible people could you use in your life? Call us at 1-844-PRESS-PLAY to let us know. Or you can hit us up on our Facebook page or the Twitter feed. Coming up, we're going to check on all things movies. That's next on Press Play.
listen to KCRW's 24-hour all-news channel, stream BBC World Service, NPR, and KCRW programs, continuous coverage, and accessible via our smartphone app or online at kcrw.com.
This is Press Play. I'm Barbara Bogave in for Madeline Brand. Well, it's January, and especially here in the home of Hollywood, we all know what that means. Pretty slim pickings when it comes to movies. But it is our sacred duty, nonetheless, to fill you in on what's coming out today. Matt Achety is editor-in-chief of Rotten Tomatoes. Hi, Matt.
Hi, thanks for having me.
It's wonderful to have you here. And Jenna Bush writes about movies and pop culture and is the founder of the Women in Sci-Fi community, Legions of Leia. And welcome to you, too.
Thank you.
First up, a thriller starring Jennifer Lopez. Oh, this is just my favorite. I can't contain my excitement. As a MILF with a teen stalker. It's called The Boy Next Door.
Hey, Mrs. Peterson.
Hey, Noah.
Oh, looks perfect. You tell him what happened this weekend?
What happened?
Oh, there was a big thunderstorm up here. You guys didn't get it up there?
No, beautiful. Dry as a bone at the lake.
Well, it got pretty wet here.
Wow.
Well, you know, I'll walk out with you, Noah. Yeah, come on. Do you want to take a cookie for the road?
I love your mother's cookies.
That line, I mean, I hope it's full of lines.
Right,
like
so
that,
can we rename this movie MILF and Cookies?
MILF and Cookies is my favorite name for a movie.
I will admit, I read that online. I didn't come up with it.
I really want to see this in a theater where people talk back to the screen.
Yes. Wow, it looks terrible.
And I don't even know why I'm asking, but Matt, fill us in on the plot.
Well, so this is not the worst casting I've seen as somebody being a literature professor. That dubious distinction goes to Mark Wahlberg in the Gambler earlier this year. But this
Fair
movie
enough.
Has Jennifer Lopez as an AP English teacher in high school. And her son goes to the school where she teaches. And a young man moves in next door, moves in with his grandfather, and is planning to go to the school where she teaches, and they bond over their mutual love of Homer and the Iliad, because she teaches the classics, and that's why she can't find a good man when she dates, because nobody appreciates the classics.
And but she knows the classics so well that when someone hands her an Iliad, a copy of the Iliad, she says without opening it, right?
Well, no, this is my favorite scene in the movie, is to give you an idea of how dumb, how stupid with two O's this movie is. There is a scene early on where Noah, the boy next door, the 19-year-old, the gorgeous 19-year-old who lives next door to the gorgeous Jennifer Lopez, who's never looked better in a movie since Out of Sight, I will say that. He gives her this nice copy of the Iliad, beautifully bound in, you know, embossed gold lettering. It says Homer, the Iliad. And she opens it up and she says, a first edition. You shouldn't have.
Wait, no.
Is it stone tablets?
Right. She's going to put that on the shelf next to her first edition of the Code of Hammurabi.
Oh, this is magical.
Right. It's not a scroll. So that gives you, that's probably one of the high points of the movie. This is a movie that is really, really dumb and really lurid, but unfortunately it doesn't quite go for the gusto. And that's where it's disappointing. It's almost so bad it's good.
Well, you're describing a Lifetime movie, right?
Yeah.
High production values.
With some pretty high production values.
Which is a perfect storm.
And it's directed by Rob Cohen, who directed Fast and Furious and Triple X. Both are movies that I really like. This one is not his best work. It doesn't go over the top enough. I wanted to see more. And look, I can't say that you won't have a good time if you get a bunch of friends together and have 5 or 6 or 10 cocktails and then go see this movie. But it's not good.
Well, the important question is there a drinking game that you can play with this?
Right,
because
exactly.
That feels like that would make it a lot better.
Yeah, maybe every time Cookies comes up.
Yeah,
or
maybe. I mean, my friend Ben Mankiewicz has talked about how every scene in this movie feels like it's the first scene in the movie, as if no other scenes have happened previously.
Oh, that's so
it's
surreal.
It's very disjointed and very
if
weird.
If someone was assigned that, it would be very hard to come up with.
Right, right. So you get scenes where Jennifer Lopez's character, Claire, she gets a call from Noah and who says, oh, I need you to come over at 2 a.m. After he has assaulted her in a bathroom, after she has repeatedly said this can't continue, she's like, yeah, okay, I'll be over there.
Oh, clearly. This is like Memento. She has some kind of memory.
Yeah, something
she's
like
a wise woman.
Yeah.
Well, let's move on to an animated take, although I don't want to move on, but we'll move on to an animated take on A Midsummer Night's Dream from George Lucas. It's called Strange Magic, and here's the clip.
Whoa, oh, oh, here I am.
Roland!
On my knees again.
Dad!
Why do anything?
So romantic.
Just to make it right.
I'm so on to that hair thing.
Say you understand.
Never!
Oh, I know you can.
Oh, no, I can't.
Come on, Marianne.
Come on, Marianne.
Not so much of a clip as a... well, enough of that. Anyway, there are lots of songs in this movie, but man, the snarky sitcom humor is so in your face. That was the first thing that really hit me. What's your take on this one, Jenna?
Okay, I had a major problem with this, but my main problem with this is the message that it sends to little girls. So this is a movie for children, and we find that girls are all boy crazy. They cannot develop in character unless they have their heart broken. And when one of the characters is cheated on by the man that she's with, her father still encourages her to go and marry him. Now, I have a dad. I talked to him about it the other day. No one would do that. It's just, and it's constant, really sharply nasal voices singing songs. And it also, I did ask my boyfriend when I left if we had taken acid before the movie because the back of my eyeballs itched. There are a lot of problems with this. I don't understand. Also, The King of the Fairies looks exactly like George Lucas.
Is that a rating for you?
That is a rating for me.
Itchy eyeball.
Itchy eyeballs. Yeah, there were so many problems with it. I mean, there were a couple of cute things here and there. There's a little imp that is adorable. But there's also the message that it doesn't matter what you look like, everyone deserves love. Except the main character who finally finds love, who isn't the most attractive person in the world. No one ever hates him because he's not attractive. They hate him because he's mean.
And how did all of this come out of A Midsummer Night's Dream? Because none of these messages clearly are...
You know, I was trying to distract myself from the nasal voices by thinking about this during the film, and I could not figure it out. Loosely based is all I can say.
Mm-hmm. Any fun for kids in this movie at all?
Yeah, if you turn the sound off. I mean, so...
Thankfully, there's Paddington.
Yes.
That is the movie to take the kids to see. This movie is really frustrating because I felt like the animation here is beautiful. It's a unique character design that we haven't seen in a mainstream Hollywood film. It's gorgeous to look at, and I feel that the world that it portrays is as fully realized as Avatar.
Yeah.
It's very immersive, but the song selection feels like George Lucas' iPod on shuffle on his favorite tracks. So it's this weird combination of like 60s doo-wop hits and then modern songs that clearly his kids told him to use. This feels like the production that George Lucas was given by Disney to distract him while they were making a Star Wars movie.
Oh, wow. Jenna's eyeballs are itching and my ears are, I don't know,
it's
they're
terrible.
On fire. So let's get back to some drama. Jennifer Aniston stars in the movie Cake. And let's listen to this.
I have to get something off my chest. Okay. I am in a lot of pain.
I know.
You may know, but sometimes I suspect that you think I'm this uncooperative old bitch who's just making all of this up.
Do you want to get better? Really? No do you want to?
I do.
What is this about, this movie?
This movie is about a woman who is struggling with chronic pain, and it's a vivid portrayal of what it does to somebody's personality. And you see this woman, played by Jennifer Aniston, go through her day-to-day. She kind of gets, early on in the film, very early on, she gets kicked out of her support group because she's too nasty, and she's, you know, addicted to a lot of painkillers, and she'll... you know, make her housekeeper drive her down to Tijuana so that she can go and get more painkillers because she's burned through all of her prescriptions up here in LA. The movie has some mystery as to why she's in such pain. And I think that the reveal of it later in the film, I think actually somewhat takes away from the story in that it somewhat depends on this mystery, or the movie would have you believe that there's this big mystery about it, which I think it actually ends up distracting from the performance and the story of this woman, which I found to be very compelling and a very good performance by Jennifer Aniston. Now, I do want to say there's a lot of people that have gone crazy over this performance and they're comparing it to Charlize Theron in Monster. I think that's a little over the top.
Yeah, I felt like, I mean, I loved her performance. I thought it was fantastic. And I think it was fantastic in the way that many actresses are fantastic. I don't think it reaches Monster level, but I did really love it. But the whole physicality of it sort of felt like I used to do theater and it felt like somebody doing Elephant Man and the physical transformation you have to go through. And so I thought it was really wonderful. But the whole thing about, oh, she didn't wear makeup, so she should get an Oscar. I don't know. That actually really bothers me because we could just judge it on her performance and not that it doesn't have to be that thing. I don't know.
She's very charming. She's got a lot of charisma, and she abandons that here. And I think that, if not brave, that's the most telling thing about her performance, yeah. Is that, you know, she does look a bit dowdy, but she really carries herself as someone who is trying to move past the pain she feels, and she really inhabits the role. And I think it's a very strong performance. Now, there's probably more money in doing these great rom-coms, but you love to see someone like that really push themselves into a different area of acting.
Well, from pain to a zany heist movie starring Johnny Depp, here's Mordecai.
I am Mordecai, Lord of Silverdale. I should like to request a bucket of ice, do not disturb sign, and a bulldozer.
Checking in?
Yeah, we're checking in.
I suspect that I may need to redecorate.
Do you need help with your bags?
No, I do not need help with my bags. I have a bloody manservant.
And this is the movie that is about mustaches, right? Or as
yes.
The marketing campaign would have us believe.
Of course. I believe this is sort of in a Peter Sellers kind of a style here. But you know how we were saying it's nice to see people break out of the roles that they're always in? I don't think Johnny Depp is doing that here.
No, he must do that reflexively now in his sleep.
Not even
a cliche. I mean, that literally.
Yeah. I think he likes to go and have fun doing movies. And he's doing something that he clearly looks like he's having a good time. That doesn't mean anyone in the audience is.
Yeah.
How about the rest of them? The other mustaches?
Well, you know, he's got the really good mustache. This is a movie. I haven't seen this because it hasn't been screened for critics.
Yeah.
Right. But you missed the screening of this. But what are the other critics?
The critics on Rotten Tomatoes don't like it. It's currently hovering at about 9% on our tomato meter. Now, that's only about...
That is abysmal.
That is abysmal.
Yeah.
Now, that's less than 40 reviews right now. So we'll see more reviews come in. But nobody hides a good movie. I know that the studio will say, oh, we wanted to get this in front of the audience, in front of the critics, instead of the critics, because the critics won't respond to it. You know, maybe there's some hurt feelings still over The Lone Ranger, where that whole filmmaking team came out and said that the critics killed that movie.
That's not what killed that movie.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, look, like especially as the guy who runs Rotten Tomatoes, I'd love to think that critics will make or break a film. And I think in a lot of cases with smaller films and platform releases, they absolutely do. But if you make a big blockbuster and it's terrible and nobody's interested in it, like The Lone Ranger.
Yeah.
God only knows who that movie was for, then nobody's going to go see it. And I think Mordecai is in danger of that because, yes, it's based on a book and they've got this huge campaign, but nobody knows what the movie is about. The critics that have seen it say that, yes, it feels like a 60s caper movie. It feels like 1967's Casino Royale, which is widely seen as one of the worst spoof movies of all time.
Right,
that's hardly recommending it. But to do our audience a service, what is it about?
Johnny Depp plays this man who is this minor noble in England who's an art dealer, and he's a dimwit. And he gets involved.
Upper class twit.
Yes. Upper class twit of the year, as we remember from Monty Python. He gets involved in a international art heist. And he's married to Gwyneth Paltrow. And he's being seduced by Olivia Munn. And Ewan McGregor is the cop who's trying to get to the bottom of things. And somehow.
Okay, it is the Pink Panther.
So it is the Pink Panther. Yeah.
Yeah. Maybe just go back and watch the 60s heist movies.
Perfect.
Yeah, you'd be better off.
You heard it here.
Yeah.
Jenna Bush is a movie writer and founder of Legions of Leia, and Matt Atchity is editor-in-chief of Rotten Tomatoes. Thank you both. It is so fun to have you in the studio here.
Thanks for having us.
Yeah, thanks for having us.
And it's great to have Warren Olney in the studio here to tell us about what's coming up on his show.
Here again, we will be talking about measles and the people who don't get their children vaccinated on time or vaccinated at all, a growing movement among people who are wealthy and well-educated.
Yeah, although I heard that the numbers are going down, that fewer people are requesting the exemptions.
That is true.
right? So that'll be really interesting. It's a moving story. Thanks, Warren.
Okay.
That's coming up on To the Point. And on this show, coming up, earlier we learned about virtual boyfriends. Now car companies are faking the sound of engines when cars get too quiet. We'll hear about that and all things automotive next on Press Play.
This podcast is produced by KCRW, a nonprofit public radio station based in Los Angeles. We rely on listeners like you. Support the podcasts you love by becoming a member. Go to kcrw.com/join.
This is Press Play on KCRW. I'm Barbara Bogave, in for Madeline Brand. Ah, the sound of a V8 engine. Is there anything more American than that? It represents power, the freedom of the open road, grit, gears, and determination. And if your vehicle was made in the past few years, it might just be a fake noise. That's right. Your new Mustang might be lip-syncing that low engine rumble just to make you feel good. Why? Why would your car lie to you? Aaron Robinson is on the line with some answers. He's executive editor at Car and Driver. Hello, Aaron.
Hi, Barbara. Lying, that's such a harsh term. I'm not sure I buy it.
No? Augmented. What are you, smooth talking? What?
We're talking about augmentation here.
You're going to split hairs with
fabricated.
Me. Okay, well, listen, I have a Prius, so I know that this is a safety issue, that it's so quiet pedestrians can't hear it, but that's not what we're talking about here, right? Car manufacturers are enhancing sounds, right? Or are they just faking it outright?
Well, there's a little bit of a both. I mean, yes, there's, you know, a little bit of Milli Vanilli going on here where there's actually a substitution of sound, but really there's more augmentation. And the reasons, there's a few reasons for this. One of them is because cars are becoming increasingly rigid for crash protection and also for drivability. And there's more insulation in them because the car companies want to get rid of all the sound you don't want to hear, which is road and wind noise. And so engines are getting a bit more quieter for that reason. Also, there's some very tough regulations that the car companies have to pass, especially in Europe, for drive, what they call drive-by noise or pass-by noise. So cars are getting quieter because of that. There's also another factor, which is that car companies are increasingly moving to turbochargers, and turbochargers squelch sound. That's just part of what they do. And then something that's been happening for a number of years, which is that the induction systems are getting sealed up for emissions, and most people don't realize it, but it's actually the induction that makes most of the noise, not the exhaust. People think the sound comes from the back of the car. No, it comes from the front of the car where the engine is making that big sucking sound. That's actually the best sound that you hear.
Well,
so those are the reasons.
This is all really interesting, and they all sound like, the fact that cars are quieter things all sound like good things environmentally and every other which way, but I'm assuming people are upset about this and they want the sound of their V8 engine. Is that what's, are customers driving this?
Absolutely. And, you know, there's, people understand that there's a reason why rich guys open their wallets for Ferraris. One of the big reasons is because Ferraris sound so good. And sound, especially in a sports car, is very important. But every company is trying something. I mean, BMW has been doing sound augmentation through their stereo for a couple of years now. The BMW M5 does it. Ford has been doing it. They do it on their Mustang, especially on the four-cylinder EcoBoost, which frankly doesn't sound that great. I've actually pulled the fuse on the stereo of the Mustang to hear what it sounds like without the radio. And it's fairly subtle what the radio is doing. It's just pumping it up in certain frequencies to make it sound a little sharper. Porsche does it with a completely non-electronic system, just a tube that comes off the induction system. They call it the sounds imposer, and it's got a little flap in it so you can make it louder or softer depending on your own personal preference. Volkswagen has one called the sound actor, which is actually a speaker underneath the hood. So a lot of companies are doing it.
And you said one didn't particularly impress you, but do they sound real?
Well, real. Yes, in a sort of a movie kind of way, they do. I, you know, the M5 to me sounds the most synthetic, but it's also a good sound. It's kind of a meaty, deep, rumbly sound, which is kind of what you expect the car to sound like, but, you know, it's not, does it sound like what the actual engine sounds like? It's maybe a little bit better. And even the F-150, the Ford F-150 pickup truck, if you get the turbocharged V6 EcoBoost, that has sound playing through its stereo speakers as well. So it's, and that, again, you know, it sounds good. It sounds refined. Does it sound like the actual engine? Maybe.
Well, I don't know where you fall on the gearhead purist spectrum, but what are they saying and how much controversy is this kind of audio flim-flam tomfoolery causing?
Out there on the blogosphere where people say whatever they want to say, I think there is definitely some criticizing of this. And in general, cars are becoming more synthesized. Our control over them is becoming more limited. And this is just part of that. But there's that scene in The Matrix where the guy's eating the steak and he says, I know the steak is fake, but I don't care. It tastes really good. And I think there's a certain acceptance of that in cars, which is that I don't care that the sound is fake. It sounds good to me. And that's all that really matters. I'm the guy that's making the payments on it. That's all that really matters.
So does this mean when I'm waiting for someone to get out of their parking space, it's because they're mixing the right engine sound in their soundscape?
Well, that actually creates the question of, will we be able to create our own sounds for these cars? As far as I'm concerned, it's only a matter of time before some auto company allows you to use your own digital files, and it could be anything from cats meowing or parrots screeching to F1 engines or motorcycles, and then you can make your own sound, and that's probably not that far away. As a matter of fact, if I was a car company, I'd be working on that right now.
Okay, moving on away from the gas pedal to the brakes, the federal government is issuing new guidelines for car makers about what kinds of brakes they should use. What are these new brake systems?
Well, the federal government is telling car companies that they're going to have to make as standard equipment a system that's been on an option on many cars already, which is an automatic warning and braking system to tell you when the car in front of you is stopping or slowing down. Rear-ending, as we all know from driving around Los Angeles, is one of the most common accidents. And because people are looking at their phones or thinking about puppy dogs or whatever it is, they run into the back of people. It's one of the most common accidents. And so what these systems do is they have an ultrasonic sensor on the front, which is constantly sending out sound waves. And it acts basically like a radar. And it not only knows that there's a car in front of you, but it also knows when the car is coming at you because it has stopped and you haven't. And it sends the signal to the dashboard, to the driver, with a light, often a beep. And if you don't do anything, it will actually hit the brakes for you. And this has been an option on certain cars. And now the government is saying, that's a great idea, guys. We're glad you've made money selling it as an option. Now we want it on everything. And this has followed a pattern in the industry where the car industry comes up with some great idea for safety. They sell it as an optional safety package or a technology package. And then the government says, that's a great idea. Now we want it for everybody.
Well, are there any concerns about using these automatic sensors, applying the brakes to your car? What if they malfunction?
Well, of course, there's always the issue of, you know, great, your brand new car stopped, but the guy behind you in the Dodge Dart, he didn't, you know, or the, you know, Chevy Impala, he didn't, you know, he doesn't have the system and he's going to run into the back of you. So maybe you've just moved the accident back one car. But the fact is that, again, this is a really common accident, rear ending. Just happened to me a couple of weeks ago on the 110. And this really does help you. I mean, I've driven cars that have this system, and, you know, if I'm tuning the radio or operating one of the plethora of accessories that this car has, and I've turned away for just a half a second, the car is still looking out for you. So it's going to tell you that the car in front of you has slowed down or stopped. And so it's really a good thing. It's hard to find fault with it.
Well, this is just a recommendation. Will it have much effect? It's not a mandate.
Well, it will be a mandate eventually. This follows a pattern, anti-lock brakes, stability control, backup cameras. These were all optional items at one time that the government said now they have to be standard. And the government's attitude is safety should not be just for wealthy people. I mean, you know, leather interiors, nice stereos, yes, that, you know, should be for the people who can afford it. But safety should be for everybody. So if the industry comes up with an innovation, everybody should get it. And that's their feeling about it. And that's why these things become government mandated.
Aaron Robinson, he's executive editor at Car and Driver. And good luck with your insurance premiums after that. Thanks a lot, Aaron.
Great. Thanks very much.
Jolie Myers is here bearing gifts known as feedback.
Oh my gosh, and gifts I have for you. In honor of the movie that I'm totally going to see this weekend, that would be The Boy Next Door.
The MILF Next Door.
The MILF Next Door. We asked you for your So Bad It's Good favorite movies. On Facebook, Lucas Elder nominates Howard the Duck, and we could probably just stop
that
there.
That is arguable.
I'm sorry, but that movie is the Citizen Kane of bad movies. But we will push
Line
on from
drawn.
There. Kenyon Johnson Young says that Face Off is so bad it's good. Face Off stars Nicolas Cage and John Travolta, and I treasure this movie so hard. Let me play you a classic moment from Face Off. This is Nicolas Cage. He's just boarded a plane.
Would you like anything else once we're airborne?
Oh, peach. You know, I can eat a peach for hours.
Okay, but apparently there's a movie called The Apple that takes the crown for Bradford Cragg back on Facebook. And one more. This one is nominated
in
by...
In the category of fruit also?
We've moved on from fruit here. Okay. This one's nominated by Benita Mehta. She says, Earth Girls Are Easy. What more could you want?
Love that movie.
Jeff Goldblum as an alien. Gina Davis as the love interest. The 80s golden.
Oh, that's the best. Thank you so much. That was a lovely note at the end of the...
Told you I had gifts.
Of the day and of the show and of the week. Thanks, everybody, for listening. I hope you all have a great weekend. We're done for today, but stay tuned for To The Point, coming up next here on KCRW and KCRW.com.
Support for Press Play comes from the Kane Foundation. Rick and Suzanne Kane and Jenny, Maggie, and Sari Kane. The Kane Foundation is committed to enriching the cultural and civic life of Los Angeles. For over a decade, the Kane Foundation has made strategic grants to make Los Angeles a better place to live for future generations.